Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, December 5th, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on Amtrak and the possible resurgence of the non-delegation doctrine. My name is Christian Corgan and I'm the Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today we're pleased to welcome two experts and also a very distinguished moderator. And so what I'm going to do is turn it over to our moderator, Brian Callinan, who is an associate at King & Spalding. Brian's going to basically run the call. So I'll stop there. And, of course, as always, we'll have your questions after our two speakers have given their presentation. So, Brian Callinan, the floor is yours.
Thanks a lot, Christian. As Christian mentioned, the focus of today's program is an interesting constitutional case set to be argued on Monday, December 8th, and that is Department of Transportation versus Association of American Railroads, or AAR. With us to discuss the case today, we have two truly distinguished panelists. Ron Kass is the president of Kass & Associates and the dean emeritus of Boston University School of Law. In his role as chairman of the Center for the Rule of Law, Dean Kass filed an amicus brief in support of the Association of American Railroads in the case we'll be discussing today. In addition, we have Professor Michael Hertz, who is the Arthur Kaplan Professor of Law at Yeshiva University's Cardoza School of Law and co-director of the Florsheimer Center for Constitutional Democracy. I should mention at the outset that I did represent the National Federation of Independent Businesses and the Cato Institute as amici in support of AAR in this case, but today I'll be wearing the moderator's hat and will, of course, strive for neutrality. I'll begin by laying out briefly the background of this case before turning it over to our panelists to discuss the party's arguments before the court. Now, any student of administrative law is familiar with the traditional non-delegation doctrine, which in its current form requires that Congress prescribe an intelligible principle to guide a federal agency's exercise of delegated regulatory power. This case involves a lesser-known doctrinal cousin of the traditional non-delegation doctrine, and that is the rule against private party delegations, which traces most clearly to the Supreme Court's 1936 decision in Carter versus Carter Cole. Now, in that case, the Supreme Court invalidated a law that gave private entities the power to devise binding labor standards without any government involvement in their creation or approval. The so-called private party non-delegation doctrine is an area that the Supreme Court really hasn't squarely revisited in over 70 years. Now, by way of background on the regulatory scheme at issue in the case we're discussing today, this case really centers on the role played by Amtrak. Congress created Amtrak in 1970 to provide passenger rail service. That rail service had previously been provided by private railroads as part of their common carrier obligations under federal law. One of the conditions for relieving private railroads of that common carrier obligation was the requirement that those private railroads allow Amtrak to travel over their tracks at rates mutually agreed by the parties or prescribed by a regulator. In addition, and importantly for this case, Congress also granted Amtrak a preference over freight railroads in using those tracks. By law, these private, predominantly freight railroads essentially have to give way to Amtrak unless federal regulators order otherwise. In that sense, Amtrak and private railroads are competitors not for customers, but for track time. This case concerns Congress's most recent effort to improve Amtrak's performance, the Passenger Rail Investment and Improvement Act of 2008, known as PREA. Section 207 of PREA, the provision really at issue in this case, directs the Federal Railroad Administration, which is the railroad industry's regulator, along with Amtrak, to jointly develop what are known as metrics and minimum standards for measuring the performance and service quality of passenger train operations. Section 207 further provides that if the FRA and Amtrak can't agree on those metrics, the matter will be submitted to binding arbitration. Now, the regulatory effect of those metrics and standards is the subject of some dispute in the case we're discussing today, but AAR focuses on two important regulatory implications. The first is that Congress directed that, to the extent practicable, Amtrak and its host rail carriers, those private railroads, quote, shall incorporate the metrics and standards into their access and service agreements. Congress also provided that the failure to meet those metrics and standards triggers an investigation by the Surface Transportation Board concerning whether the delays on tracks are attributable to the freight rail carrier's violation of the statutory preference I described, the duty to give way to Amtrak trains. Penalties can follow from those investigations if the board concludes that the freight carrier violated that longstanding statutory preference in favor of Amtrak. Now, in March 2009, as directed by Congress, the Federal Railroad Administration and Amtrak together jointly developed metrics and standards. Those standards went final in a regulation that was implemented beginning in March 2010. Soon thereafter, the Association of American Railroads filed suit asserting two constitutional claims. AAR contended first that Section 207 of PREA violates the non-delegation doctrine and the separation of powers principle by, quote, placing legislative and rulemaking authority in the hands of a private entity, Amtrak, that participates in the very industry it was supposed to regulate. The second claim was that Section 207 violates the Fifth Amendment's Due Process Clause by, quote, vesting the coercive power of the government in Amtrak, which is an interested private party that's been given the ability to, quote, enhance its commercial position at the expense of other industry participants. The district court granted summary judgment for the government on both of those claims, but a unanimous panel of the D.C. Circuit reversed, holding that Section 207 does constitute an unlawful delegation of regulatory power to a private entity. The court noted what it called the quote, unprecedented regulatory powers delegated to Amtrak by Section 207, observing that the scheme that under this scheme, Amtrak, quote, enjoys authority equal to the Federal Railroad Administration. The court also rejected the government's argument that Amtrak should be treated as a governmental entity for the purpose of the non-delegation doctrine, which all agree would cure the non-delegation doctrine problem in this case. The government petitions for certiorari and the Supreme Court granted cert on the question whether Section 207 of PREA is in fact an unconstitutional delegation of legislative authority. Now, with that background, I will turn it over to Professor Hertz, who will focus on the government's arguments in this case.
Okay, great. Thanks so much. Just a few general words to situate the claims. As Brian said, Carter Cole is the key precedent here, and it looms over all the arguments. In Carter Cole, the Supreme Court struck down an arrangement for writing sort of codes of conduct and wage and hour rules for coal mines. And the regime was that within each geographic district, producers of two-thirds of the coal could write a set of rules, and then all the other mines had to go along with them. And the court famously called this delegation in its most obnoxious form, language which is quoted in all the briefs, because it was a delegation of pure regulatory power to private entities. As the D.C. Circuit saw this, this is just Carter Cole all over again. It's a case of pure private lawmaking. Amtrak's a private entity. It's imposing legal requirements on others in its industry. That's per se impermissible. The government is painting a different picture. The government is not saying that delegations to private entities are just fine. One could say that. There are people who have said that, and it's not a crazy argument as a delegation argument. The point would be that what the non-delegation doctrine, which ultimately rests on the vesting clause, which places all legislative authority in Congress, what it prohibits is Congress giving its legislative authority to someone else. And who the someone else is sort of irrelevant if that's the underlying concern. It's supposed to be Congress. Anybody else is no good. And so it doesn't matter who the delegatee is from a non-delegation point of view. A lot of people have said there might still be a problem with that. Indeed, I think most people's gut tells them there's something amiss with a participant in a particular market regulating other players in that market. And the D.C. Circuit gives the example of GM regulating the manufacture of automobiles. The respondent gives the example of Burger King regulating McDonald's. That sounds wrong. But it might be a due process problem, an interested party wielding governmental authority, rather than a non-delegation problem. In any event, the government is not arguing that there's just no issue with delegation to private parties. What it's arguing is that that's just not what's happening in this case. And so it's got four basic reasons why, even if Carter Cole lays out a flat rule that you can't delegate to private entities, Carter Cole is not violated here. So what are those arguments? First, it emphasizes that Amtrak is not the sole actor. Amtrak, of course, is deeply involved in writing these metrics and standards, but it develops them jointly with the Federal Railroad Administration, and after required consultation with stakeholders, including another government entity, the Surface Transportation Board. I got to say, I think the requirement of consultation with others doesn't help the government at all here. It's a version of notice and comment rulemaking. The question is who has the authority to make the rules, not who they have to talk to first. But the involvement of the FRA is meaningful and important. So what the government phrases it as follows, the metrics and standards, quote, could not take effect without both the active participation and the independent assent of a governmental entity. All right, so that's point one. It's just not pure private lawmaking. Second, if Amtrak and the FRA can't agree, because they might not agree, they agreed in this case, but they might not agree, what happens then? The statute provides for binding arbitration, that the STB, the Surface Transportation Board, would identify an arbitrator and the disagreement would be resolved by the arbitrator. For the DC Circuit, this feature is a huge piece of the problem, and the respondent repeats the argument, because the arbitrator might be a private entity. And so at that point, if we go to binding arbitration, then the claim that there's a private, public entity involved in this collapses if the ultimate decision maker is a private arbitrator. So the government's response to this is that actually a proper reading of the statute indicates that the arbitrator must be a public official. That phrase, the term public, doesn't appear, but neither does the term private. It just says binding arbitration, and with the odd term that the parties would be assisted in reaching agreement by binding arbitration. A little tension there. So the government claim is that it's just a statutory interpretation problem, that when Congress wanted to permit private arbitration, it says so explicitly, and so the silence here is meaningful, that private arbitration doesn't make sense here, and that if private arbitration creates a constitutional problem, it amounts to a private delegation, then the canon of constitutional avoidance dictates that one should read the statute not to raise that problem, which one avoids the problem by reading it to require a public arbitrator. So those first two arguments really come down to this, that the railroads won below by taking a kind of categorical approach. There's a bright line. Congress can't delegate to private parties. That's what this is. And what the government is saying, in essence, is, well, it's not that there are two categories, public and private. There are three categories. There may even be a sliding scale, but there are at least sort of there's public, there's mixed, and there's pure private. And Carter Cole is pure private, but there are a bunch of cases that are in the mixed category. The old cases are Curran against Wallace and Rock Royal Cooperative and Sunshine Anthracite Coal against Adkins, all of which in one form or another involve some collaboration between private and public rule writers, and all of which were upheld by the Supreme Court. And that's the category, that middle category in which the government would place this. There's enough governmental oversight, enough government participation to distinguish Carter Cole and get us out of the pure private category. Okay, two other arguments are quite different. So the third is the government says that these metrics and standards simply are not regulatory requirements. Right? Brian quoted the language in the D.C. Circuit opinion about, you know, an unprecedented grant of regulatory authority. Government says this just isn't regulation. They have no actual operative or coercive force. So the metrics just measure things. The standards set a certain level that's supposed to be accomplished. But if that level is not met, doesn't lead to liability, doesn't lead to any consequences except that it triggers an investigation. That's all. And the investigation is not about were the standards violated. The investigation is about was the statute violated, the preference that Congress created in the statute. And so the failure to meet the standards or the information revealed by the metrics is irrelevant to the determination of actual liability, is irrelevant to the imposition of damages. It's not part of the showing that must be made. It's not evidence of a violation, but not proof. It's just irrelevant. Now, the possible weaknesses there is if we show, well, actually, these do have some real-world consequences, then it looks more like these are regulatory in nature. Brian mentioned that the statute requires the railroads and Amtrak, to the extent practicable, to include the metrics and standards in their operating agreements. And if they're in the operating agreements, that would suggest they have some legal force in some way. The government says, no, it only says that to the extent practicable. It's not a flat requirement. The other thing I'm just curious about, I just simply don't know the answer, is, have they been incorporated in the operating agreements or not? If they haven't been at all, that's good for the government. If they've been written in a lot, that's good for the railroads. The fact that I believe the respondent's brief doesn't tell us makes me think that they haven't been written into the operating agreements, but I just don't know. The other issue about the government's argument here is that all people seem agreed that while these metrics and standards were in place, Amtrak's on-time performance significantly improved. They made a real-world difference. That's why one of the reasons various people care about this. The one amicus brief supporting petitioner is from railroad riders. This is good for Amtrak. And so if they really did have some effect, and after they were struck down by the D.C. Circuit, Amtrak's on-time performance went down again, that might imply that that they have some real effect, and that makes them look more regulatory. The response in turn to that is simply that, well, okay, they helped with enforcement of the preference, but they didn't actually require anyone to do anything. You might analogize, the government doesn't make this analogy, but if the government set up some great tip hotline so it knew more about violations and therefore can enforce more effectively, you wouldn't say the tip hotline was a set of regulatory requirements, it just helped enforcement. Last argument from the government, this is in a way the most obvious one, right? It's what you can't help but wonder about. Last argument is Amtrak is not a private entity. It looks, walks, quacks like a governmental body. Many things about it are governmental. It's laden with a bunch of statutory requirements that Congress would not impose on private entities and have really very little to do with making a profit. Its board has a 9-member board that consists of the Secretary of Transportation and 7 members appointed by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate. Those 8 then pick a 9th. It gets tons of federal funding. It's never been, never turned a profit. It gets more than $1 billion a year and is absolutely dependent on it. It's subject to FOIA. It's an agency for FOIA purposes. And perhaps most importantly, the United States Supreme Court held it's a state actor for First Amendment purposes. And you roll all that together and boy, it looks like the government. The D.C. Circuit and the respondents disagree with this, pointing out that the statute itself says that it should operate as a for-profit corporation. It's got a .com website, not a .gov website. The statute says that the people working for Amtrak are not federal employees. There's only so much relevance that the statutory label can have. That was one, we've learned that in many cases. The Lebron case, the First Amendment Amtrak case, is one. And more recently, the Free Enterprise case about Peekaboo is the most obvious example, where the statute said these members of this board are not federal employees. And of course, the Supreme Court found as a constitutional matter, it doesn't matter what Congress said, they are. And that's why the double forecast protection was problematic. I think just the last thing I would say, the fact that Amtrak gets these enormous subsidies, the fact is not just relevant to whether it's a governmental actor, but it lends some flavor to the whole thing, as does the statutory preference. Congress apparently thinks that Amtrak's service is in the public interest. That's why it gives it the preference. That's why it gives it the money. It's enough in the public interest to justify the taxpayers paying it over $1 billion a year. And at the bottom, a lot of the concern in this case, a lot of the rhetoric or the flavor of the case is about the difficulty of a kind of not just the triumph of an individual faction, but the triumph of a specific private interest, especially within the marketplace. And so the self-dealing is what makes one so uneasy about a private delegation. It's not clear whether that's really relevant here, partly for all the reasons the government gives explicitly, and partly because, you know, the whole setup here is to deal to Amtrak. Congress, which is disinterested by definition, has set it up this way. And so even if you view this as Amtrak kind of pursuing its own interests, doing that is not actually pursuing a private interest. It has virtually no private shareholders. They're not making any money on their stock to the extent they exist. It's the pursuit of a public interest defined by Congress. And the government's brief doesn't make that point explicitly, but I think it's sort of aiming at it between the lines and sometimes quite close to the surface. So I will stop there.
Thanks, Professor Hertz. Next we'll hear from Dean Kass.
Well, Professor Hertz has done a good job of laying out the basic arguments in the case and what the positions are. I'm going to spend a little time on the position taken by the railroads, but I'm also going to try to put this in a slightly different context. And let me first start with the context and then get to the position that the railroads have laid out. The context really begins with the structure of government that we have. We have separated the government into different branches. Each branch, when it is discussed in the Constitution, we start with a vesting clause saying that the legislative powers are vested in the Congress, that the executive power is vested in the president, and the judicial power is vested in the courts. These separate vesting clauses have been taken to give guidance to the courts in a variety of cases where they are trying to see what sort of features government is permitted to enact. So when Congress creates an enterprise where Congress reserves to itself the right to appoint some of the members, the court steps in, as it did in Buckley and Valeo, and says that that violates the structure of the Constitution. The president gets to appoint the officers of the United States who perform executive functions. You can't reserve that to the legislature. When Congress sets up a scheme where it allows someone who is conducting studies and doing things on behalf of Congress to also have executive authority, the court again steps in, as it did in Bauscher and Siner, and says, you can't do that. Again, you are overstepping your bounds. This is something that belongs in the hands of the executive. Again, the case that that Professor Hertz mentioned toward the end of his remarks, the Free Enterprise Fund case. The court has looked at something Congress has done and said what you've tried to do is to create a hybrid in a way that allows executive functions to be performed, but to be performed by somebody who has a sort of insulation against executive control, which violates the structure of the Constitution. So in a variety of ways, in a variety of cases, the court has had to confront Congress doing things that blend functions in ways that appear not to have been contemplated by the constitutional structure that we were given and not to be permitted by it. The question that is at issue in a variety of cases that deal with delegation is whether Congress has done effectively the same thing, whether it has taken the legislative power, the power to create rules that will bind private citizens, private entities, with the potential coercive force of the government enforcing and giving weight to those rules and regulations. Whether Congress has taken that power and given it out to another entity, and if so, whether that violates the constitutional structure. In the classic line of delegation cases, what the courts have done is try to articulate a line that separates unconstitutional delegations from enactment of rules that are then being administered by an executive official. And the line that we have that goes back to 1928 is whether they have constructed an intelligible principle under which the executive is acting. The line of cases that is dealt with in the briefs here is a line that is related to that, but deals with a question of whether you can ever delegate executive functions or the creation of rules, which is a legislative function, to a private entity. The courts have fairly consistently over a long period of time, and most emphatically in Carter against Carter Coal Company, said that that is something that cannot be done consistent with the Constitution. But it's not just Carter and Carter Coal. This was an issue that was addressed in the Schechter case. It was an issue that has been addressed in a number of other cases. It was addressed in part in the Hampton case that gave us the intelligible principle doctrine. And the courts have very consistently said no one would think that you can give one private entity or one private body or one private official, one private person, authority to create rules that will then be imposed on other individuals. That's the issue that is being addressed at the level of the legal doctrine in this case, and the argument that is made by the D.C. Circuit, the argument that is made by the railroads in their brief in this case, is that it is a simple matter, it can't be done, that the areas where it looks like something akin to that has been done are areas where a government official has written rules, the rules are going to be taking effect, and private parties have been given leeway. You have a group that is subject to the rule. You need a supermajority vote to make them subject to the rule, or a supermajority vote to determine when the rule will actually take effect with respect to that group. But you don't have rules being written by private entities. So for the railroads, this is a simple proposition that you have no leeway to say you have a mixed enterprise, you have something that is mostly private but not entirely private. Private entities simply cannot adopt rules that have impact on, that affect and bind other private parties. So that's the first line. The second line, and I will get back in a minute to the factual question that Professor Hirst notes is very important in this case, which is the nature of Amtrak. The second line is not up for decision in this case, and both Brian and Professor Hirst noted that there is a due process question that is addressed by the court below. The court says that as a matter of due process, you can't have a self-interested party that is charged with decision-making affecting another party. There's a variety of cases that deal with clearly governmental officials who cannot, because of some self-interest, be allowed to make decisions in certain matters. So everyone, I think, agrees that to the extent you have a self-interested party making decisions that violates due process, technically that is not a question before the court in this case. It is one, however, that has been given a small bit of attention in the brief from the railroads. The application of the rules to Amtrak is a big question before the court below and in the briefs here. Professor Hirst has already noted the questions regarding the division of authority between Amtrak and the government in adopting these regulations. Amtrak and the Surface Transportation Board are essentially co-equal in this. The argument made by the railroad is that when you give a private party a co-equal status with the government, where the private party can resist the adoption of rules that the government wants to enact, then you've given the private party a rulemaking authority that is way greater than is permitted under any precedent. And the argument that the government makes that the creation of an arbitration provision solves this, the railroads say it's quite the other way, that nothing in the law specifies that the arbitrator will be public. Nothing identifies a public official who is going to be tasked with the job of arbitration. And it is at least more likely than not that you would have private arbitrators doing this if the arbitration is something that follows the ordinary course. You often have private arbitration on matters where there's an impasse. It is harder to find handy public analogs that would be written here. But certainly the argument that is made by the railroads is that the government is engaged in a little bit of reconstruction of the statute after the fact and what it is doing. So from their standpoint, this is another problem with the statute that is independent from the problem of having Amtrak helping to write the rules. There is also attention in the brief to the variety of ways in which the metrics and standards become important in the operation of the railroads. The fact that the Amtrak trains are essentially competing for space and time with freight trains, that there is, to the extent you have a judgment made that there is a deficiency in the on-time performance that is caused by a failure to meet the metrics and standards, there can be separate damages that are awarded as a result of that. There can be separate penalties that are imposed as a result of that. And as the railroads lay the case out, the impact of the metrics and standards is quite significant in the operation of the rails. The fact that you have people actually spending good money to fight over this is another indication that that may be so. Finally, the argument about whether the statute makes Amtrak public or private, there's a lot of attention given in the railroad's brief to that question. And the argument that they make essentially is that, first of all, when Congress says this is a private entity, it is not a governmental entity, its employees will not be government employees, and goes on laying out a series of ways in which the government, the Congress thinks this is not to be deemed a governmental enterprise nor treated as one. So the railroads say that, first of all, you have to take that as something that is not just in there for show. When they come to the question of how much that binds, they say this is exactly the opposite of the Lebron case, because in Lebron, the question was whether Congress, by its designation of Amtrak as non-governmental, could avoid obligations that go with the government when it acts. So to the extent that the government is supporting Amtrak, funding it, financing it, are there obligations that go with that, even if there aren't privileges that go with it, so that government can't use this mechanism to get around its obligations to treat people fairly or to engage in the sort of protections that come with free speech. But what the railroads also say is the fact that it is certainly not entirely governmental, in many ways is non-governmental, means that the government can't use it to leverage additional powers to this private entity. And the analog would be that when you have a private university that gets public funding, there can be obligations that attach to public funding. There can be non-discrimination obligations that go along with that. But that doesn't mean that the private university then gets rulemaking power or other government powers, so that giving a lot of money to MIT to do research may require that they spend those funds in a way that doesn't violate constitutional rights, but it doesn't give MIT the ability to write rules and regulations that will govern Harvard and Yale and Columbia. So that, in essence, is the case that is laid out there. I'll note just one other thing that is not in the brief, but as an administrative law professor, could have been, and that is, as Professor Hirst noted, 8 of the 9 members of the Amtrak board are appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate. One is not. Under the rules in the Constitution and the court cases that give them life, this is not an entity that can exercise governmental power. It can't exercise the sort of authority that needs to be exercised by an official, an officer of the United States, without having its members appointed by the constitutional standard for appointing officers of the United States. So if this were not a delegation case where we were arguing about legislative power, but it were instead a case where we were arguing about executive or administrative power, that would be something else I think you would see thrown into the case. And with that, I will stop, and I know we have an opportunity for Q&A. I will turn it back over to Brian.
Thank you, Dean Kath. And I will. I know Christian is going to make a call for questions from the listeners.
Yeah, so we'll now open the floor to your questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. And after that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key.
And as the folks...
Go ahead, Brian.
As folks are queuing up for questions, I will kick it off with a somewhat broad question, which is, you know, putting aside the specific regulatory scheme at issue here, how important is the outcome of this case as a practical matter? One sort of surprising element of the briefing in the case, to me at least, was that the government hasn't suggested that AAR's position, if accepted, would call into question any other schemes under federal law that involve private party participation or self-regulatory models. I wonder, from our panelists, why do you suppose that is? Is there a reason to think that this decision could call into doubt other regulatory schemes, or is Section 207 really a kind of anomaly in the law?
Well, this is Ron Cass, and I'm willing to go first on this. I think that depending on how the court handles this, it could be written in a way that calls into question a variety of schemes, but most of the self-regulatory schemes are conducted under the supervision of, at least those that are done at the federal level, under the supervision, fairly active supervision, of a clearly governmental body. In the states, you have some self-regulatory regimes that look a little different, and those may be open to question, but they would not be on the grounds, assuming this is done as it certainly will be, on grounds other than due process. It would not be on grounds that are equally applicable to the states.
This is Michael Hertz. The premise of your question seemed to be assuming the court strikes it down. I mean, the consequences would, first of all, depend on the outcome, but second, as Ron says, hugely on the reasoning. Look, there's a reason why we're talking about all these cases from the 1930s, right, which is that private delegations have not been a prominent part, constitutionally questionable private delegations have not been a prominent part of our legal regime in our lifetimes. And so what it reminds me of really is the Free Enterprise Fund case where, the majority said this is not that big a deal. One sees very few double for-cause arrangements. Justice Breyer insisted that there are a lot of them out there. There's essentially an empirical debate, but also a question about exactly the scope. On the other hand, the rhetoric of the Chief Justice's in that opinion in that case was very strongly pro-president, pro-unitary executive, and I think the rhetoric over time may be more important than the actual holding. My inclination is to think that if the court affirms, which I don't think it will, but if it does, the rhetoric will be more consequential than the specific holding, and so one would have to see how it played out over time.
All right.
Christian,
well,
do we have some calls? Yep.
Yeah, we've got one question on the line, and our lines will be open. So we'll go to our first caller.
First of all, thank you very much for a very, very interesting and thoughtful discussion of the legal issues. I think you're all to be commended. In terms of the issue that I'm surprised the government really isn't spending much time on arguing, it strikes me that Amtrak, if it quacks like a duck and waddles like a duck, you conclude that it's a duck. And that is that, well, this is a public entity, and it's reminiscent a little bit of the analysis that the Chief Justice gave in the decision that where he concluded that the Obamacare penalty was indeed a tax, even though Congress did not label it a tax, and in fact specifically failed to label it a tax. And that had consequences. That meant the Anti-Injunction Act didn't apply, which is strictly a matter of congressional discretion in their statutes. And I guess that you could make that argument in terms of the Civil Service Acts and whatnot. But that constitutionally, when you're talking about delegation to private party, a constitutional issue, a constitutional standard may say, this is a public entity. Just wondered if that has been argued at all.
Well, yeah, no, it has. If I downplayed, I may have given the wrong impression. The government absolutely insists that that Amtrak is a public entity, not a private entity, and that all those indicia I mentioned, the makeup of the board and the subsidies and the First Amendment case and so on, all add up to this being the government. And that's certainly the cleanest way out of the case from the government's point of view. But obviously that's its last argument, and it gets about as much attention as each of the others. I think that the utter if I was the government, the utter confidence of all three Court of Appeals judges that Amtrak is a private entity, which they paused over, but they didn't seem uncertain about, would make me as a lawyer a little nervous about just saying, oh, this is the obvious answer and the Supreme Court will go with me. And so they have, I think, appropriately, strategically, laid out all the other arguments. But they haven't, I don't think they gave that one short shrift.
This is Ron Cass. I think that one of the things you see when you look at the briefing and when you read the decision below is that this is not simply a case where you have a government, a regulatory agency that has a little bit odd shape to it. This is a corporation that is being chartered by the federal government. It is a corporation that is given a for-profit mission. It is a corporation that is not led by people who are entirely officers of the United States, so not appointed in the way that government officials would have to be appointed. It is an enterprise which is expressly freed from a number of different rules and requirements that apply throughout the government. And so even if at the end of the day one might say, well, I think it is more governmental than a lot of other things are, that the degree to which it has indicia of government make it more subject to certain things than others, it certainly is not an easy case to say it's obviously government. And the fact that we're not talking about is it government for purposes of restraining what it does, we're talking about whether it's government for purpose of enabling it to do things that only government can do. I think that gives it a tougher climb to simply say, well, yes, it's government. And for that reason, I think you see the judges below saying, from their standpoint, it was clearly not, even if they had to slog through a variety of provisions to get there.
Yeah. If I could just, it's Michael again, just add two very quick points. One is that the briefs that don't address this issue actually include the amicus briefs written by both of my the other members, speakers on this call. And I think, you know, from the railroad's point of view, this would be a bad way to lose because it's a loss. But in terms of the larger issues here, you know, one could imagine the court, you know, deciding that, writing an opinion in which it came out strongly against private non-delegation and just found this is not an instance of it, and that would be a result which many of the drafters of the amicus briefs supporting respondent, they can speak for themselves, but would not be utterly unhappy with if the general principle was confirmed and this is just a place where it doesn't apply. The other thing, just quickly on the appointments clause, Ron, I mean, I suppose if Amtrak is a department, the appointments are okay because the appointment would be made by the head of a department. I'm not sure I would really want to make that argument, but it's not beyond the pale.
This is Ron just jumping in one more on that little point, and that is that for this to be the head of a department, it would have to be the board itself. So having the head of the board appointed by the other board members, I don't think even if you declare it a department, would cure the problem.
You mean because it's not the board until all nine of them are there?
Right. Right.
Maybe. Yeah. Maybe.
That's a little. This is what we're here during.
This is real inside baseball. Yeah.
All right. Well, this is Christian. Our lines are open, so and we've got about 10 minutes left. So if you'd like to ask a question, please press star and then the pound key.
Great. Thanks, Christian. And I'll jump in again with a question about what our panelists think the justices' predispositions might be in this case. You know, we generally associate non-delegation concerns with conservative or libertarian legal thought, but one would at least expect that delegations to private businesses might be more likely to raise alarms on the left, such that, you know, liberal justices might be more receptive to some of the policy concerns raised by AAR. No doubt this is complicated by Amtrak's quasi-public status, but I would just ask, how do you think the members of the court will be predisposed in this case? Do you expect sort of a breakdown along the customary ideological lines, or might there be some surprising alliances?
Well, this is Ron, and I'm always glad to hear someone ask about the justices' predisposition because so much of the newspaper attention is on their disposition. I have to say that I don't find their decisions case by case so easily characterized on a left-right, liberal-conservative spectrum because there are so many different ways in which you can look at issues, different concerns that permeate them. And here, as your question identifies, Brian, you have concerns about the scope of government, the nature of government, the way it imposes rules and regulations on private parties, how the different branches relate one to another, the way you interpret the text of the Constitution, all of those things come to bear. And I think you may find that in this case there is some difference in the way people look at it that is not easily cabined on a single spectrum.
I guess I'd say that in general, I totally agree that the concerns about delegation to private parties, some of them, you know, folks on the left would be concerned with a slightly different set of issues than folks on the right, I think, in that I think folks on the right would be worried that private regulation, A, would be anti-competitive, and that might be a concern less shared on the left. And they'd certainly be concerned that it's just a way of getting more regulation. The more regulators you create, the more regulation you'll create. And this, of course, informs the non-delegation debate generally, that one of the reasons folks on the right are, would rather see a robust non-delegation doctrine is that it would there would be fewer lawmakers and therefore less law. And that would be less of a concern on the left. The concerns on the left about private lawmaking might be more about ignoring the concerns of regulatory beneficiaries who would be more left out, or giving power to large entities at the expense of small entities, or a general kind of exaltation or celebration of corporate America, somehow those sorts of issues. So there is that divergence, but the bottom line is, A, they both should be concerned, and then B, there are other issues which are not ideological at all about private delegations, about it being undemocratic, the formal argument about it's just not the government, about the process that shouldn't be ideological. So I think that in terms of bottom line, and one can find plenty of writing on both sides of the political spectrum expressing concerns about private delegations. That said, look, this is a case where the panel below was Brown, Sentell, Williams, where the amicus briefs, have a strong ideological bent. It feels like a heavily ideological case. It's sort of a shame that it does, because it needn't. I would expect that the respondents will get more sympathy from the group generally seen as being on the right, notwithstanding what Ron just said. The one thing I would say, I think that Justice Scalia, I think I can predict Scalia and Breyer, because it's not just ideological, it's also sort of jurisprudential. I think Justice Scalia votes to affirm because this is a case in which his kind of anti-delegation leanings and his pro-president leanings, which sometimes are in conflict, here are totally allied or aligned, and that he might even find an argument that's not so much in the briefs, which is, his view of delegation is that agencies are exercising executive authority. They haven't received legislative authority. They can't. And if that's what you think is going on with rulemaking, then there's an Article II problem when a private party does it. It violates the Take Care Clause. It violates the Executive Vesting Clause. And I could imagine Justice Scalia making that point here. And the other thing is the sort of categorical approach that the respondents are taking and the D.C. Circuit took is a Scalia sort of approach. Justice Breyer, of course, hates categories. Justice Breyer believes in, sliding scales and multi-factor tests and under all the circumstances. And I think under all the circumstances, he would find, you put all this stuff together, this just isn't the delegation to private parties. So those two, at least, I think I can predict.
This is Ron. I just want to say I'm glad, Michael, that you think the argument about the composition of the board will come back then in another version as an Article II problem.
Well, Brian, we've got about 5 minutes left. What do you want to do a last call for questions before we wrap things up?
Sure.
All right. Well, to our callers, if anyone's got a last-minute question or comment that you'd like to make or pose to either of our speakers, please press star and the pound key now. Last call.
And unlike law school, I guess we can't call on them.
That's right. No, they're all sitting in the back. Exactly.
A lot less callers if that were the case.
That was always my seat. But I do have a final question, at least for myself, which is, and this is a question about sort of if you see trends in the court's approach to administrative law. We've seen the court take a number of high-profile cases in the administrative law domain. Just this term, the court will be hearing, the court already heard arguments in the mortgage bankers case. We have the AAR case. Last term, the court heard the UARG case. Do you see an increasing interest on the part of the court in administrative law issues? And do you see any trend? Do you discern any trend in the court's interest in these cases and in the outcomes of these cases?
Well, this is Ron. I have to say, it's wonderful having a court with so many former administrative law professors. It's great that they're taking these cases for those of us who have case books and reasons to revise and put out new editions. They give us plenty of reasons. But also, they take these questions very seriously. They take questions of constitutional structure very seriously. They take questions of judicial review seriously. I won't say that their Chevron jurisprudence is a model of clarity, but I will say that they keep going back and reexamining it. Given the argument this week in the Labor Department case, I think it is likely that they will tell us something that they have not said for a while since Vermont Yankee about administrative process and procedures and what the APA means. And I think we are in for some more interesting cases over the coming years, assuming the court stays pretty much like it is.
I'd associate myself with those remarks, and I'd say that the big picture question is deference in all its forms. And I say, just how muscular, how robust is the court with regard to agencies? And I think one of the things about the Rehnquist court was, you know, many critics of that court thought it was sort of imperialistic, that it was too non-deferential just across the board to Congress, to everybody, quick to find things unconstitutional and so on and so forth. I think that completely mischaracterized its administrative law jurisprudence, which overall was actually fairly deferential and was not the only counter example to the standard critique. I think the Roberts Court is a little more robust, a little more confident, a little less willing to defer. But you know, no single case will make or break that description. But if you're asking about an overall trend, I think there's a slight overall trend of that sort.
Great. Well, this is Christian. I want to go ahead and make one quick programming note that should be particularly relevant for everyone on this call. Obviously, if you're on this call, you're interested in this case. On Monday, after this case is argued, we will be having a special Courthouse Steps edition of our Teleform conference calls. We're sending an expert to the court to watch the oral argument. So Monday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, we will be doing, as I said, a Courthouse Steps edition of the call with an expert. So please remember to call in and get our experts' impressions of what went on at the court and the oral argument. So now that we're out of time, I want to take this opportunity to thank, on behalf of the Federal Society, all three of our participants today, Dean Kass, Professor Herz, and Brian Callinan. Thank you very much for being with us. Thank you to our audience for joining us. We always welcome your feedback by email to info@fedsoc.org. And please do join us on Monday for the Courthouse Steps version of this Teleform. And remember that you can find the podcast of this call, as well as all of our other Teleforms conference call, on our website in the future. So until next time, we're adjourned. Thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.